Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Charlie. How are you doing?
Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Charlie. I'm doing well. Tim, glad you're doing well.
Okay.
What are we drinking? What coffee are we drinking?
Today we have coffee from Japan. You want to hand me a bag, Tim? And this is K's Coffee, K-E-I Coffee. This is literally from Japan. And I thought it was very good. It is a dark roast, but Tim, I think I agree with you. It's a good dark roast.
It's a very good dark roast.
It has a pleasant roastiness to it. So this came from the deadly duo, Abigail Kelly and... Laura Huggins. I don't know if they're the deadly duo.
Why are they the deadly duo?
Well, I just know Abigail because she always refers to me on campus as not a Dr. Stearns because Dr. Ellis asked her to say that. And Laura Huggins is in Greek, so she gets credit for that. I think it's from Abigail. I think they both went to Japan. I know Abigail did. And they thought, oh, we should bring back some coffee. So we have more international coffee. I love getting international coffee. One of my favorite things. Mm-hmm. So thank you. We appreciate that. And then we're also drinking Tim's Ethiopian.
Is that it? Yep.
And I would say that on the light roast scale, that one's excellent.
All right. So I do want to mention we're at 190 reviews.
Oh, man, we're getting close.
And the last one was actually a 5-star review by one of the owners of Brick House Coffee Co. in Lawrenceburg, Iowa, Missy Jones. I'm assuming this is the same Missy Jones. There could be another Missy Jones out there, but says love listening to it every week. And, you know, Brick House is one of our normal people that we mention. And so I'm actually planning to go there soon.
Oh, man.
I'm taking a day off to go work on class stuff.
Oh, that's a great idea.
You got your Brick House Coffee Co.
And
mug
I'm drinking out of a Brick House coffee mug right now. So we are still trying to get to 200.
Listeners, please help us. I'm really tired of Charlie bringing this up every single episode.
Why is Tim interrupting Charlie? Oh, because he's so tired of this.
Tim hates reviews.
Now, you understand, Tim, by saying that, some of our listeners are going to be like, I'm not going to review anymore. I want to hear Tim all wound up.
So we need 10 people. We need 10 people to serve the Lord and leave us a 5-star review. Along with that, we have Booksing Day coming up.
I'm so excited.
Which, if you don't remember your history, last year we unanimously voted to make Booksing Day a holiday. It's like the day after Christmas is commonly called Boxing Day.
Yeah.
And that's super lame. So instead of...
Easy. Whoa. Yeah. Easy. Easy. We don't mind Boxing Day for real, but we also like our holiday that
we
made.
What did you just do?
I used the Canadian national anthem to be honoring to the Canadians who actually celebrate Boxing Day.
Is it a Canadian thing or is it more like
Canadian? It may be English, but come on. It's a Commonwealth thing.
So, whoever celebrates Boxing Day, good for you. But instead of Boxing Day, we want to celebrate Booksing Day. And so want to normalize giving books as gifts for Christmas and then reading them on December 26th. Instead of playing with, you know, that newfangled toy or putting your Christmas decorations away,
you should get a mug of coffee
and you should read a book that somebody gifted you, and you should gift other people books. So the Faith Bookstore wants to support Booksing Day.
Ooh, we do.
So if you go to Faith Bookstore and you buy a book, and you mention to them, this is a Booksing Day gift, you will get 25% off.
I'm excited. Can't you hear it in my voice?
I'm pumped.
We can.
The bookstore manager
is. It's a very subtle excitement, but we can hear it.
It's diminutive.
Lachem.
It's demure.
Lachem, demure. I was going to say demure.
I don't know why that's a thing, but a lot of like younger people are saying things like that. I hear people say that, demure. And I don't know what they're referencing, but it's probably something bad. So we'll move on.
Sounds cap to me. I literally can't use the lingo these days, Charlie.
Yeah.
I used to be able to hang with the on fleek, throw the shade, all that, but I can't figure out the cap and all that. Mm. And Sigma, apparently. Sigma and Beta and Alpha. Those are no longer letters in the Greek alphabet.
You know what they're never going to do? They're never going to do that with the Hebrew alphabet.
Exactly. That's right.
Because they don't
beta,
know it.
Gimel. Yeah, take that, you Gimel.
All right, so here's what's in this episode. We're going to do books and business. I'm going to talk about A River Runs Through It. in Books and Business and in the main content.
Double.
And then I'm not sure what the other guys are doing. Oh, it's down there. That's not updated.
So, mine is. Mine's accurate.
It is?
Yep. I'm going to talk about Today's Christian and the Church's Bible by Theodore Letus.
I just saw mine and it was the last week's title. And Tim, are you talking about the Lingua Latina parts?
Oh.
Parts one? That doesn't say parts. Whatever parts. It is.
It's Latin.
Okay.
Oh, Latin. Okay. You said Latina. I was like, oh, are we? Okay.
So we're going to do that for Books and Business. And then I'm going to talk about A River Runs Through It. And then at the very end, Tim is going to have a final meditation in 2 Timothy 2. All right. We're ready to go.
I don't think we can go quite yet.
Is there something else we need to do?
There is.
Books and Business.
There it is.
Hey, there we go.
Let's talk about some books. And so I'm going to talk about A River Runs Through It in the main content. Just to kind of prime the pump, I'm going to read a paragraph from my copy, which is on page 3. Well, until man is redeemed, he will always take a fly rod too far back, just as natural man always overswings with an axe or golf club and loses all his power somewhere in the air. Only with a rod, it's worse, because the fly often comes so far back it gets caught behind in a bush or a rock. When my father said it was an art that ended at 2 o'clock, he often added closer to 12 than 2, meaning that the rod should be taken back only slightly farther than overhead, straight overhead being 12 o'clock.
That was an excellent quote. I loved that.
I might disagree a little bit.
With what?
Well, an axe. You know, if you miss with the axe, it's, I think, worse than getting your fly stuck in a tree or something because you swing too far. Anyway.
I don't know. Well, we'll have to come back and talk about that in a little bit.
Do you want me to go next, Tim?
I can go, yeah.
Okay. I know you like to go clockwise, so I didn't want to break clockwise.
I don't want to break
clockwise. Listener, one time I was playing a game with Tim. It was like 6 of us from Sunday school. And we decided to go counterclockwise, and Tim had a conniption. It was like he could not handle himself. And so we literally had to stop and reverse directions. And ever since then, I have known you only go clockwise when you play games with Tim or do anything.
Listen, it says in the Bible that everything's supposed to be done decently and in order. Okay. Clockwise is decently and in order. So Lingua Latina is a Latin grammar. It teaches Latin deductively. So we started this, I think I talked about it quite a while ago in the summer. My boys and I were reading through this Lingua Latina, learning some Latin summer, Sunday or morning devotions and Latin. We haven't been doing as well since the school year started, but we're still doing it semi-regularly. And I really like the book. It's reading a story. And so the kids actually can get the story. The one time the kid, he's like not the brightest kid and he's climbing a tree to get into a bird's nest and he falls and he hurts his arm. And then they bring the doctor and the doctor's not the brightest doctor. And the kids are laughing because the doctor is checking his foot and the dad's like, no, it's not his foot. It's his head or something, you know?
Oh, that's great.
And so the kids are reading through and they're just kind of laughing as they're translating through this Latin book. Probably one of the downsides is it teaches some of, you know, I'm working with junior high boys here. And so some junior high boys language, you know, so one of the words is like fuetus. Fuetus is ugly. Because the one person doesn't
wait, what
like
is it?
Ugly.
What is the word though?
Fuetus.
Fuetus. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. But anyway, the one person is like, doesn't like how they look. And so they think they're fuetus. And so of course, as junior high boys, what do they be? One of the words you don't have to teach them to memorize. They've got it down. Stultus is like stupid. And so doctor is stultus. And then we hear a lot of stultusing going on. So
wow.
It's kind of fun because they'll start using some of the Latin just in regular conversation. And one of the kids in my one son's class, you know, the Latin word for mother, it looks like mater. And so he learned, oh it's mater, because he's using basically English pronunciation. It's not supposed to be. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Exactly. That's so really he says, hey, mater, you're my mom, mater. So he starts calling his mom mater. For some reason, she didn't like that too much. So anyway, it's been kind of fun. And my kids have really liked the grammar. And so if you were like, you know what, I want to work through Latin, I would recommend it. It's a fun way for the kids to learn. They stay pretty engaged and it teaches them to incorporate it into some everyday language. Lingua Latina, pars uno.
That sort of reminds me, man, Sorry, listener. I haven't coughed at all like this morning, and then all of it happens. I know I'm known for this. That kind of reminds me of in high school when you're learning Spanish and there's certain words you learn that are not in the curriculum and you remember them better because right. you're a junior high or a senior high
yes.
boy. I'm with you on that one.
Yep.
So the book I'm going to talk about today is called Today's Christian and the Church's Bible, subtitle, A Time to Return to the Authorized Version by Theodore Letus, PhD. It lists that on the cover. So we have a thought on this. Well, I don't know. I know Tim and I do. I think Charlie agrees, but I'll just let him confirm it. Tim, what were you saying? Like, you kind of have to put PhD on when you don't sound as reputable, but if you're reputable, you don't have to. But how do we think about that?
Yeah, it's like, it was, in the publishing world now, okay, we're trying to write books and, you know, where is the place of titles? And the answer is nowhere. That's what we've kind of deduced and learned.
Isn't the title on the cover?
Glorious. Charlie, 2 points.
Very good. So, you know, putting doctor on or whatever else. And we had a little bit of an incident once where it was like specific people were taking the title and other people weren't. And it's like, why is it that certain people are using the title and certain people aren't? And actually, a lot of it has to do with their public speaking. If you have somebody that's a regular public speaker, then they're usually identified by their title because it kind of ascribes some authority to the speaker. But in the publishing world, I don't think it's not common practice. You don't put titles on it.
Well, and I think especially for this one, because of the topic and the argument he's going to make, I think that's part of it. Now, here's the weird thing. If you want to look him up online, Tim, he's actually has some really reputable doctorates, this guy.
Yeah,
he's on the steering committee of some translation thing for SBL. He's in the American Academy of Religions. He was, sorry, he's passed away. I'm so sorry, listener. I don't know what happened here. But why do I have this book? It was $6 at my local bookstore. And I thought, oh, this is, I teach Greek. I teach a Bible study. The King James comes up. I've read a pile of books on this. I'm like, I'll read this one. And it is, wow. Couple things to talk about here. Number one, I read this and today I was preparing for the review and I was trying to think of the specifics again. And look what I got in my back cover, my back flyleaf. Nice. I summarized it. So listener, when you get done, write a quick summary. And this is saving my day here. Number two, I would say that 2/3 of this book I completely reject and is horribly poorly written. I have read better junior college, like junior level college papers, like junior, senior, like I have read better papers of the poor students at the junior level than the writing of this book. The argumentation is very hard to follow. Some chapters are not even, they're like 3 pages. His arguments are non sequitur all over the place. Now, what I think is if this guy really is academic, maybe he's summarizing his academic work and he's assuming too much knowledge on part of the reader. If I'm taking a really charitable review, maybe that's what's going on. So but 1/3 of this book I actually strongly agreed with, and that's why it's not hitting the shack stack. In the last third of the book, I would say that's the most persuasive part, but it still doesn't prove his point. It just proves a greater point. He makes the argument that the reason there are so many translations today is that publishing houses want to make money, and the Bible makes a lot of money. And I totally agree with this. Tim, you shared this when Dr. Little here will come to my introduction to Bible study class every year on campus. And he does a whole day on good book binding practices and how to find a Bible that is bound well and will last more than like 2 years as a college student. And then he also talks about how to take notes in the Bible, what you should and shouldn't write. It's really great. We've done it. How many, like 10 years? It's been a long time.
Quite a while.
And it's been really good. But in it, you often, and this year made the comment that why are there so many Bibles out there? And I remember it's they want to make money.
Yeah. Money, copyrights.
Yep. And I remember when I was at Southern in 2018 doing a little bit of post-grad work, the teacher said the reason the CSB, the Christian Standard Bible, which is put out by Brodmann Holman, which is a Southern Baptist publisher, the reason it was put out is because the Southern Baptists were tired of paying so many royalties to NIV.
Right.
Because they were publishing NIV snippets in their Sunday school curriculum.
Right. So, and the NIV is owned by HarperCollins, which is just a big corporation in America.
So Letus, I do like that point that he makes. He makes the point that we don't need all these translations, and most of them aren't, they're not as concerned about accuracy. They're more concerned about making money. The problem is that he thinks this supports his argument that the authorized version of the King James is the right one because it's copyright free. Go ahead.
So I don't know. That's kind of tough because a lot of the people on the translation committees, they're not getting paid. Okay, they're not making money. It's the publisher that's making money. And so it's like the mode, I don't know, I just know that most of the people that are doing the translations, at least the major ones, they're usually scholars that have, they're really trying to contribute something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's like, what I was going to say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry, that's where I was going. No, it's okay. That's exactly what I was going. Okay. The point here is that I think when you have godly men and committees trying to do a good job, that's different. But I don't think that that proves that now we have to use the authorized version. So there's a number of problems with this book. I don't think it's recommendable. I thought, I got to look this guy up. Like, who is this guy? So he died in the last decade or two. I can't remember when. He was on his way to a gig and he got in a car accident. He's also a jazz musician, like pretty accomplished apparently. But before that, he was doing all kinds of work in this field and whatnot. And as I researched him, I found a bunch of YouTube videos where they have his voice, not his like a video of him. In one of them, he was going at James White. And James White has that very well-written book, The King James Only Controversy. And in it, he said James White makes this one. He picked one little thing that James White said in this little snippet. And he was going at James White. And in it, he said, you know, Bart Ehrman literally proves this point, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, he's quoting Bart Ehrman? Wait. It almost sounds like he agreed with Bart Ehrman. So I'm looking up research, and there's questions on if this guy even believes in inerrancy. So, listener, I have not gone far enough down the rabbit hole to know for sure about this, but this is what I was beginning to see. It sounds like his argument on the whole is the text is an ecclesiastical object, not a corporate or financial object. So the text is owned by the Church General. So the best translation should be done by the church as a whole. And he says the AV is the only one that does that. That's his greater argument in his life. Now, I think part of the ways he argues that is that look at what text the church used for virtually 400 years. The AV gets published, the King James, and then every sermon in the Protestant Reformation, every article, everything, it's only the King James that's being used. So he says, see, God used it so much, that means it is the translation. That is like I don't know what kind of a fallacy that is, but it's like everyone's using it. It's like a bandwagon almost, but it's more like a preponderance of usage argument. Well, if everyone says 2 + 2 = 5, that doesn't make it right. But then he also you have this like wrong, you know, you have this text here. And then part of his other argument I find out is that he thinks the Greek did have errors in the original autographa, if I read them right, and that the scribes corrected those errors over time, and that became God's word, and that is the correct text for us today. He essentially accepts, I think he's accepting Bart Ehrman's conclusion, and he's saying, no, that's how God did it. So he's essentially saying it was bad here, and then we've corrected it. Well, isn't that like, then how can you argue against like the Catholic Church that did it wrong the whole time and the Protestant Reformation adjusts it? Well, what if we're just doing that going backwards and we're looking at earlier versions and we see, hey, maybe this is the correct reading. The whole thing's wonky. So I would not recommend it. I think there's too many weaknesses in this book. It's tiny. I saw it recommended on Canon Press's website of all places, but Wilson is a big like church translation guy. And I think he limits himself mostly to the King James. So the Today's Christian, the Church's Bible, I won't shack stack it because I would use this for research. I'm giving it a 1. There's that one section I sort of agreed with. I don't like it at all. It's not a good book, but I'll give it a 1. I don't know. That's a review.
Let's have a conversation about A River Runs Through It. This is a fun one. So, journey here of this book. I knew of the movie and watched it, you know, probably 10, 15 years ago, somewhere in there in my adolescence. Brad Pitt, young Brad Pitt, plays the Paul is the character that he plays.
Was that BC Charlie? Like before, like even before, like BC?
Before you were a Christian.
Wow, that's a long time ago.
But so there's a movie, and like many movies, it's based on better books. And so I was a library in Ames with Sawyer Gogarty, and it was like giving away books pretty much, or like you get like 10 cents a book or whatever. And so I saw this on one of the stacks, and I'd watched the movie, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll pick this up. So it's, you know, usually books you get for free aren't really worth much. And there's a reason that they're giving them away for free. That being said, it kind of made it through its kind of realms and pacing in the stacks of books. And I was like, you know what? I think I need to give this a read. And started reading it a while back. And you guys have heard me talk about that already. And it is a book about fishing. But it's also not a book about fishing.
It's about splitting wood. No.
I don't know where you're going with that.
But, well, that quote that you had earlier.
Well, yeah. We'll get to that quote. So I'm going to read the first line of the book. First line of the book here. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. Okay, so right away, you're kind of like, well, what's going on here? The story is told from the narrator, Norman, and he's discussing mainly, he's focusing on his brother, Paul. Their father is a Presbyterian minister, and they've grown up in Montana. And so again, here's the, you know, like two rivers, here's two really big things in this family's life, fishing and religion. And opening line of the book is a great one. In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. So you could read through the book and you could say, oh, it's about a guy and fishing. And there's a lot of really technical parts where he's talking about how to cast and how to find fish and different types of flies and all that. So you could read through it and you could say, oh, it's just about fly fishing.
Huh.
But what he's doing is he's setting up a metaphor to actually think about religion.
Hmm.
And not religion in our sense, like a very creedal, like confessional type of theological statement, but he's pondering deeper questions of life, a religious aspect of life, through the lens of a river and fly fishing. So that's kind of a quick, like, what's going on here? And to give you the main characters, Norman, again, is the author narrator, and his brother Paul is, according to the book, he has far surpassed every fly fishing man, woman in Montana. He's the best fly fisherman there is.
Okay.
He also has some profound struggles. So drinking, sleeping around. He's a reporter, doesn't particularly like his job, gambling. There's some scenes where, you know, his brother, Norman, gets called to go get him out of jail. So you have on one side a very skilled artisan of fly fishing, but deeply flawed. The story, essentially what happens is Norman's brother-in-law, Neil, who's a real dandy, he's a college-age young man, and he's from Montana originally. He comes back on the train, and they describe him. He shows up. He's got two sweaters on, and you know, he likes to tell the girls back east at school that he's a fly fisherman, but he really just fishes with bait. You know, it's kind of like a deep insult. Like,
wow.
And what the story is essentially brother-in-law comes and mom, wife, sisters are like, you need to take Neil fishing. You and your brother, Paul, need to take Neil fishing. And so that's pretty much the glimpse that we get is through that scenario, we see Paul and Norman and Neil, among others, going fishing multiple times. And each time we're at the river, each time we're interacting with these characters, the narrator, Norman, is giving a lot of deep thought upon the troubles of his brother. And right next to the trouble of his brother is the trouble of his brother-in-law. So the differences between the two, Neil is a horrible fisherman. Paul is a wonderful fisherman. They both drink and run around with the ladies and, you know, all of this deeply flawed, sinful existence. but one of them is a master fisherman. And so we're kind of watching this either comedy or tragedy take place. And I'm going to read another portion here. This is on, in my copy, it's on page 63 and 64. At this part in the story, they're out fishing. It's a really hot summer day. They've left Neil behind with another lady. I'm going to wink, and you can't see that on the podcast. This is a lady of ill repute. This is not the lady at the gate calling out in wisdom. We'll just put it that way. Okay. And they've left them behind, right. And Paul and Norman have gone on to fish, and it's super hot. Nothing's biting. So Norman's now just sitting and thinking. He's thinking about the river. He's thinking about all of these things. And he says this, as the heat mirages on the river in front of me danced with and through each other, I could feel patterns from my own life joining with them. It was here while waiting for my brother that I started this story. Although, of course, at the time, I did not know that stories of life are often more like rivers than books. But I knew a story had begun, perhaps long ago, near the sound of water, and I sensed that ahead I would meet something that would never erode, so there would be a sharp turn, deep circles, a deposit, and quietness. The fishermen even have a phrase to describe what he does when he studies the patterns of a river. He says he is reading the water. And perhaps to tell his stories, he has to do much the same thing. Then, one of the biggest problems is to guess where and at what time of day life lies ready to be taken as a joke, and to guess whether it is going to be a little or a big joke. For all of us, though, it is much easier to read the waters of tragedy. So,
that's really interesting.
He is studying the patterns of the river, and if you read the previous pages, he's actually thinking this, I think, in comparison to his brother. He's using this river fishing metaphor. He's thinking about his brother who's got these deep flaws. And, you know, he's telling this story of Paul, his brother, in hindsight. And he's, you know, and he's got Neil here as well. And he's like, you know, you start telling a story, you got to study it like you study the river. And you have to decide, is it a joke, or I would say comedy, or is it a tragedy? And you go all the way back to Aristotle and what are comedies and tragedies. Comedy, there's a fool. And when bad things happen, you're like, great, he deserved that. Great, there's resolution. The fool gets what he deserves. A tragedy is someone that is very akin to you as the reader, and you want them to succeed, and a bad tragedy happens to them. And so here in the story, you've got these two characters, Paul and Neil. And you're starting to think, okay, is this a comedy? Is there a fool here that needs to get what he deserves? Or is one of these the hero of a tragedy? And from there, how the story plays out, they actually go back that day at the river. They find Neil laying out on the beach with his, his friend. And they have no clothes on. And they're sunburnt from head to toe, which is a... you know, very painful, comedic scene. And then the whole rest of that, it's them trying to get Neil clothed and home so he can get taken care of. So you look at Neil, who's, you know, the dandy from out east. He just likes to tell people he fishes. He doesn't actually know how to fish. And, you know, bad things happen to Neil and you're like, yeah, he deserved that. He's an idiot. But then here's Paul, who's the master fly fisherman. And there's scenes where he's, you know, in the jail cell and the brother gets called at midnight to go get him. And the whole story told from the perspective of that brother is, how do we help Paul? Because he needs help and we don't know how to help him. And you keep getting clues that he's not going to get help. And how the book ends is it's Paul and Norman and their father. And his father and Norman, they're watching their brother Neil do this masterful art of fishing. And he makes a comment that I didn't know at the time, but this was the last day we would go fishing together. And how the story ends, spoiler, is a few years down the road, he gets a call. Hey, your brother was found in a dark alley, bludgeoned by a pistol. He's dead. You need to come and get him, get the body, or verify the body. And then at the end of the story, it's the dad and Norman, like, thinking about this, like, what could we have done to prevent this tragedy? And so it moves you in that sense. There's, it's essentially the relationship of four men and then the broader family. And I'll give you some positives and some negatives. So positively, I do think it gives you some interesting aspects of familial relationships to think about. It also discusses beauty directly. And we're going to get into that in a moment. You have to think about what's good and skillful and, you know, how can someone so flawed, Paul, do something so beautiful? As we read in Books in Business, their dad had taught them, you have to have grace to fly fish. And so he's doing something full of grace, a gift of God that he can master this art. But then in his spiritual life, he's absolutely destitute of grace. And so you're forced to think about that. A few negatives of the book, as we've already mentioned, there's a few scenes that bridge into some areas that aren't helpful. So you could imagine the scene and it's maybe not super great. There is language throughout the book that you have to be aware of. So I'll just put a caveat now. If I was going to recommend someone to read this, it would be a young adult, you know, 16 or definitely after, not for a young child, for sure. A young man, I think, would be intrigued by this book. I don't know. I think it was written for young men. I don't think it was necessarily targeting ladies, but you know, they could read it too. The nice thing about it is it never exalts any of the bad things. In fact, very clearly the lady friends and the drinking and the gambling, all of that is seen in a negative light, and it's pretty consistent. With the exception of maybe one scene with the drinking, it's kind of put in a sense of like fun and laughing, but for the most part, all of the bad dark is said that it's bad and dark. So I don't think there's like a, as with like Hillbilly Elegy that we read, I couldn't recommend that because it's just overwhelmingly cursing and with no ill speaking of that, it's that that's okay. I don't think I could recommend it because of that content. Here, most of the bad stuff is called bad. So that's good. So I want to just kind of think through what I believe McLean is doing. And he's hitting on a couple of big themes. And so first, I'm going to read the very end of the book. So the title is A River Runs Through It. And I would ask the question, what does a river run through? It. A river runs through it. Well, what is he? Is he just talking about the geography of Montana, or what are we getting at here? So here's the very end of the book. And this is after his brother has died. And he and his father are discussing this. And this is going to be a little bit longer of a section, but it's helpful. For some time, though, he struggled for more to hold on to. This is the dad trying to figure out how his son died. Are you sure you've told me everything you know about his death? He asked. I said, everything. It's not much, is it? No, I replied, but you can love completely without complete understanding. That I have known and preached, my father said. Once my father came back with another question. Do you think I could have helped him? Even if I might have thought longer, I would have made the same answer. Do you think I could have helped him? I answered. We stood waiting in deference to each other. How can a question be answered that asks a lifetime of questions? After a long time, he came with something he must have wanted to ask from the first. Do you think it was just a stick-up and foolishly he tried to fight his way out? You know what I mean? That it wasn't connected with anything in his past? The police don't know, I said. But do you? I felt the implication. I've said I have told you all I know. If you push me for enough, all I really know is that he was a fine fisherman. You know more than that, my father said. He was beautiful. Yes, I said, he was beautiful. He should have been. You taught him. My father looked at me for a long time. He just looked at me. So this was the last he and I ever said to each other about Paul's death. Indirectly, though, he was present in many of our conversations. Once, for instance, my father asked me a series of questions that suddenly made me wonder whether I understood even my father, whom I felt closer to than any man I had ever known. You like to tell true stories, don't you? He asked. Yes, I like to tell stories that are true. He asked, after you finished your true story sometime, why don't you make up a story and the people to go with it? Only then will you understand what happened and why. It is those we live with and love and should know who elude us. Now nearly all those I loved and did not understand when I was young are dead, but I still reach out to them. Of course, now I'm too old to be much of a fisherman, and now, of course, I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends I shouldn't. Like many fly fishermen in western Montana, where the summer days are almost Arctic in length, I often do not start fishing until the cool of the evening. Then in the Arctic half-light of the canyon, all existence fades to a being with my soul and memories and the sounds of the big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, all things merge into one, and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops, under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. I am haunted by waters.
Ooh.
So.
I could not stop listening to that entire quote. That was like really.
I still don't get it though.
Okay, good. Let's talk about it. So what does a river run through?
The canyon.
So you can, life? You could hear. Okay.
Is it life?
So he's,
I don't know. That's like,
so is the book about fishing?
Well, he said it's fishing and, well, no, but he just said, write a story that's fake so you can understand reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but what is he doing? He's telling a true story of his brother. And obviously the namesake of the book is there it's the second to last paragraph.
Right.
Eventually all things merge into one and a river runs through it. All things merge into one and a river runs through it. And what you have throughout the book, you have all these scenes of him and his brother in the river. And you know what's always true? They're never next to each other. He's either on one side of the river and his brother's over there and Neil is over there on the bank. And his dad's up there reading a book. And so he's using this river as a metaphor for life. And specifically, going back to what his dad said, it is those we live with and love and should know who elude us. So here's his brother who he fishes with all the time. And he's got these deep flaws. He needs help. And that's the dad was asking, do you think I could have helped him? And do you think I could have helped him? And so they're years after his death, pondering the brother or the son's life and trying to figure out like what was really going on. How could we have helped him? And he eludes them. And so this fishing, this river metaphor becomes a picture of the lives of this family that they never really could get to the issues they needed to get to. They could never really have the conversations they needed to have. And there's a couple of times in the story where Norman tries to help his brother. Like, hey, do you need money? Like, what do you need? And like, they just can't, stereotypical men, they can't have the conversation. And it leads to his demise. Like he dies. And so part of the tragedy is the character being lost. But then an aspect that we're forced to think about is, you know, how could we have helped him? Like, how do you help someone who's really struggling? And so fishing becomes a metaphor for, approaching beauty and interacting with each other. The river is this idea of like a deep mystery, like you can't understand it. And that's what the story does is it sets up this character who really understands the river. And it's not who you would think. So here's a deep, mysterious thing, you know, how to tie the fly, how to catch the fish, you know, where to go. And it's the, you know, deeply flawed sinner who, in a general sense, really approaches God in the sense of beauty. But then in his spiritual life, he's completely destitute. And they're pondering, like, how could we have helped him? So we're going to come back to that. And then I also think too, how does someone who can be so skillful and artistic not find the grace of God? You know, how does someone without God do something so beautiful? And we could ponder that same question today. But that's, I think, what the book is really focusing on, is this character, Paul, who has beauty. The elements of God's grace and the image of God in his life is so evident. But from the familial standpoint, they know, like, this guy's going to kill himself. And it's like a complete tragedy. And if you look around, you'll find examples of this in your own life, maybe even in your own family. And that's what I think is so beautiful about this. Off air, we were talking about the book Peace Like a River by Leif Unger. And this hits on a lot of those same, like, familial ties and strings. It just does it much shorter. This is like barely over 100 pages. It's like a short story. And so I think if you want to think about and read through, ponder some of those things, this is a great book to do that with. So I'm going to end with this question before we go to that final meditation. How do you help that person? Let's talk about that. So here's a deeply flawed person who's got all this skill and beauty in their life in a general sense, but they're absolutely destroying themselves, like, in a spiritual way. Like, how do you help them?
Man, I think that is the question. And there's probably a lot of possible answers. There's probably one that's right and one that's wrong. I'm just going to say one that I don't think necessarily is correct, but it's one that someone might say. Hmm. So today, what is the, like, out in the big bad world, if a group of friends all knows this person is, they're drinking themselves to death or they're doing whatever, they will stage a what? An intervention. Yeah. And so I don't know if that's the right thing to do, but I think that in some sense, the idea there is that, like, all of us care about you so much, we're all going to come together and tell you that we care about you. And yet that doesn't really always, it doesn't help. I mean, I think sometimes these very flawed people who do really amazing things, it's not that they don't know they're ruining their life. Does that make sense? I think the books bring, I mean, I almost wonder in the book, does this character know he's wrecking his life? Does that come up?
Kind of.
Because that's part of where, when you think about this, sometimes the person knows they're wrecking their life. They just also know they can't, well, they're enslaved. So I would think if we're turning to the Bible, we probably have some other avenues to walk down. That's what I would say. There's probably not just a general intervention.
Yeah, I mean, people are complex. And so at least what come to my mind is, first of all, you need to analyze your own life and make sure that you're an instrument that's sanctified and set apart to be used by the Lord. A lot of times we have a tendency to point the finger at that other person. We see them train wrecking their life and we're like, I want to help them. Well, how do I help them? Well, sometimes it's what you're doing is actually hindering them. So specifically as an illustration, for the book, you know, was it Neil was the guy from out East and he was the
brother-in-law. Yep.
He was like the comedy. And then the main character is Paul. And who's the other one?
So Paul is the brother that we really focus on.
That died.
But it's told from the perspective. I guess the main character is necessarily the narrator, which is Norman.
Norman. So it's like Norman's trying to help Paul. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and one of Paul's problems is the drinking. Okay. So how can you help somebody that's struggling, say, with drinking? Well, maybe you shouldn't drink. Okay. It's like, well, maybe getting drunk's not your fault. And maybe you don't have a conscience issue with it. All right. Well, do you love him? And then maybe you sanctify the Lord in your heart. You put off some of your quote unquote rights. And then you live a set apart life around that individual. And then you can help lead them away from the wrong path. So that was kind of like one illustration that just came to mind. Does Norman really want to help? How can he really help? Well, if alcohol is a big issue, then maybe there's something that we need to be moving away from. And that would be maybe a practical way that could be of assistance.
Yeah. So I'm going to give two answers here that I think is what the author intends you to think about. And then I'm going to give maybe a side commentary. So one, there's a scene in the book where they're both in the river and Norman, he knows he needs to cast into this like really like shaded, like brushy area on the edge of the river. But he doesn't want to lose his fly. And he, the difference between him and his brother, like Paul only has like four or five like generic flies. He's a master fisherman. He doesn't need like all the little lures, but Norman has like dozens and dozens in his tackle box, and he doesn't want to lose a lure. And his brother kind of rebukes him. Paul rebukes his brother. If you really want to catch that fish, you got to be willing to go and risk, and you got to cast in there knowing you might lose it, but that's how you're going to catch them. And so is it the author? And again, this is the narrator in hindsight, looking back. So what's the metaphor here? If you really want to catch that, you're out in the river, you got to go where you don't want to go. You have to go where you're afraid to go. And here's a group of men that all knew there was a problem, and they never just have the conversation. Yep. So I do think the author is exalting to us, in a family, you need to have real conversations, especially when someone's hurting. You need to address those things. And I think the author, the narrator here, is lamenting that he never cast that lure in there to try and catch his brother. So that's one thought. You have a thought
there? I was just going to add to that. So biblically, where I think the Bible aligns, or where that aligns the Bible, is that you need to speak truth to your brother. Mm-hmm. And not speaking the truth because you don't want to lose the relationship, that's actually living in a fear of that man. So I can see where that actually fits. Like, if I'm your friend and you're wrecking your life, I got to go to you. I got to go to my brother. So, okay. I know he's not saying it from that reason. I'm just saying,
I think the story is crafted in a way that you have to think about that.
Yeah.
And it's very proverbial. Is it about, well, he's just in the river. He's just talking about catching a fish, right?
He's doing something more.
Is he trying to get you to think about, like, here, we're going to go back to the quote I read during Books and Business. I'm going to read that slowly. Until man is blank, he will always take a fly rod too far back. Do you remember what the word was? It's a spiritual word.
Oh,
until a man
mature?
Is
sure. No.
Re
what?
Redeemed.
Oh.
So dad, the pastor, Presbyterian pastor, dad, teaching his kids, how do you really get good at fly fishing? You have to understand grace.
Huh.
You have to understand that you're not the one with the power. You're completely helpless.
Oh, interesting.
Because until a man is redeemed, he will always take the fly rod too far back. Just like a man always overswings with an axe or a golf club. They take the power into their own hands and they lose it all. And so what is the dad teaching about fishing, but also teaching about Paul? He's got this, he's got some sense of God's grace and beauty and the skill he's developed, but he's doing it all on his own spiritually. And the only way to solve that problem is to be redeemed. Like, now it's a subtle theme throughout the book, but here's a guy who's quote unquote found grace. He's redeemed in fly fishing. But then when he goes to his personal life, what does he do? Overswings, overdrinks, overpunches, gets himself killed. And his brother's watching this and like, what could have helped him? Well, he needed like the actual grace. And so going back to at the end of the book, how could we have helped him? The dad, could I have helped him? The brother, well, could I have helped him? What's the answer?
They should have spoke. Did they ever speak up? Do they ever confront him or talk to him? So that's the answer.
Well,
they should have spoken.
They should have.
In grace.
But I think even a little bit more, I think the answer is they could have even done that.
Hmm.
But would that have saved him?
Well, no. I see.
And I think, again, you're forced to think about what would have really redeemed this man.
Hmm.
He needed the grace of God to change him. And it's a very subtle religious theme. But remember, the very opening line of the book, there is no distinction between fly fishing and religion. And so you're learning about religious ideas through the lens of fishing. And just when you're casting that rod, and if you try to take all the power into your own hand, you're going to screw it up. And here he is all alone trying to hide or manage his sin, and he can't. And so I think that's,
wow.
And what does the river run through? The river runs through their lives. The river runs through their relationships, and the main narrator is trying to in hindsight, well, should I have gone deeper? You know, should I have said something? How could have I helped my brother? And kind of the themes as you go throughout the book is that of tragedy, where a guy so close to the grace in general revelation is so far from it in his heart. So I crafted a couple paragraphs to cap the discussion. I'm going to read these and I'm going to turn it over to Tim. All right. So what is A River Runs Through It? Paul is a character with deep flaws and possesses the grace and skill to master the art of fly fishing. Told from the perspective of his brother, we see the destruction of beauty. Not the beauty of fly fishing, but the beauty of a man made in the image of God. That man, given the faculties of God himself to know and to master, creates a masterpiece. The beauty of his art can explore the depths of the river in a way that no other character can. Although he understands or apprehends enough of general revelation to find beauty with the rod, he does not understand or apprehend the beauty or the grace of God. His brother Norman yearns to help his brother, who is withering away like the river that erodes with the pass of time. Both brothers learn together that man cannot help himself or his fellows. When he tries to do it alone, as their father taught them early in the story, man will overswing or overcast. They lose any semblance of power that they thought they had. Everyone needs help from the Lord, and the tragedy of A River Runs Through It is that a character so close to God, seemingly based on the beauty and artistic skill he has, is so far from apprehending the grace that can redeem and save his soul. While family wants to help, they cannot provide what only God can provide. A river runs through it.
Let's have a final meditation from God's word. The text that we're going to look through is 2 Timothy 2:5. But I'm going to read verses 1 through 5 to give us a little bit of context. You then, my child, be strengthened by the grace that is in Christ Jesus, and what you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Share in suffering as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No soldier gets entangled in civilian pursuits, since his aim is to please the one who enlisted him. Verse 5. An athlete is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. The second metaphor here, the athlete, is what I want to focus on today. And as we think through even the life of Paul and his situation and trying to help the Pauls in our lives, it gets into what we're seeking to do as Christians. And as I think about Matthew 9:37-38, the harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. What we're seeking to do at Faith Baptist Bible College and our local churches is entrusting the gospel, entrusting the things that we have learned to faithful men. That's what 2 Timothy 2:2 communicates. And so as we think through, okay, entrusting it to faithful men, what are we trying to do? Well, there's the soldier metaphor, which we've talked about in a previous episode a while back. And then there's the athlete metaphor. And as you try to think through the Pauls in your life and the people whom you want to help, sometimes one of the temptations is motivated out of something really good. You want them to draw close to the Lord. You want them to have a good life and to not be found dead in an alley. So as you think through this metaphor of the athlete, an athlete is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. The focus of the metaphor is that he competes according to the rules. I was talking to a couple of colleagues. We were discussing this metaphor specifically. The athlete, a lot of times, what's focused on in the athlete is that they're disciplined. So it's like, hey, you need to be an athlete. You need to be disciplined. You need to work hard. You need to do all of the things. Well, the focus of this metaphor isn't actually on the discipline. It's about competing according to the rules. Well, if you're talking to a Paul, how do you, quote unquote, help a Paul? And do it according to the rules. Yeah, let me use maybe a more negative example. I talk about Solomon. Was Solomon successful? He was successful, okay? But was he successful? Imagine being a young Jewish boy living in the days of Solomon, the golden age of Solomon, okay? And you look at Solomon, you're like, oh, mom, dad, look at Solomon. He's got it all figured out. Yeah, but you don't want to do everything that Solomon does. Why not? Look at it. Everything's good. Everything's fine. Everything's working great. It's all wonderful. Yeah, he's got 1,000 girls, okay? I think something's a little bit off here. Okay, so when we look at people and we look at their success, okay, so how are they getting that success? And are they competing according to the rules? Okay, so athlete is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. And as you think through the pulse in your life, what is it the message that you need to communicate? So you're like, I do need to communicate that message. I do need to say something to them. They're train wrecking their life. Well, what is the message of the gospel? What is the true message of the gospel? What does it look like to compete according to the rules? Well, sometimes it's not what Paul wants. Sometimes it has too much to do with an internal change and the destruction of an idol in his life. And you're like, yeah, if I push on that fly fishing, he's never going to come. He'll never believe. He'll never be redeemed. He'll never. But if I kind of tailor the message a little way, and not deal with the idols in his life, then you know what? They might come along. It might preserve their life for a little while. Okay. Are you competing according to the rules? And that's what I would encourage you to think through as you seek to help the Pauls in your life, as you seek to minister to the people whom God's brought into your life. Don't deviate from the truth of the gospel. And the truth of the gospel includes something called suffering and trials. And the truth of the gospel includes something that says no to self and yes to God. And if they reject it, then they reject it. But you need to be faithful to communicate that truth and be the athlete and compete according to the rules.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.